Okay, it is September 27th, 2010. We were at the offices of Orrick. It's now just Orrick, right?
It's Orrick Harrington.
Right. Okay, Orrick Harrington and Sutcliffe in Los Angeles, interviewing Mr. David Samble. Mr. Samble, my name's Chris Seifer. With me is Al Crago and Claire Moraine. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by the end of this year, December 15th. That statute tells us to look at many things, including the role of securitization, the role of the originate-to-distribute model, the role of non-traditional mortgage lending, et cetera. That's one of the reasons, or some of the reasons, we're looking at Countrywide, and some of the reasons we thought it would make sense to talk to you. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. Before I ask you to summarize your educational work background since college, I think counsel wants to just say something for the record quickly.
So Reggie Brown and Salomo Trivedi for Bank of America, which acquired Countrywide. We would like to designate the interview as confidential. To the extent that Mr. Samble reveals information that would be Bank of America confidential information, we do not consent to the use of it by third parties, including book publishers.
And we would join in the same designations and objections on behalf of Mr. Samble.
Right. And I think we've provided both you guys with our standard confidentiality agreement, so that'll be dealt with down the road with our general counsel. So with the preliminaries out of the way, Ms. Temple, could you please summarize your educational work background, starting with college, please?
Yes, I went to college at Cal State University in Northridge, where I studied business and received a degree in accounting. After college, I graduated in 1982. I went to work for two different accounting firms. First, the firm of Alexander Grant, which subsequently became Grant Thornton. I was an intern while at college there. And then I moved over to Ernst & Whinney, which subsequently became Ernst & Young. After leaving Ernst & Whinney, I started work at Countrywide in 1985. My first job there was as the director of the internal audit department at Countrywide, having worked as an auditor in public accounting after school. After a short period as director of internal audit, I was asked to move into one of the business units that was the subject of an extensive audit, an audit report that I wrote. It was a mobile home lending business that Countrywide had owned at that time, and really my job was to essentially liquidate that business. Countrywide had elected to get out of that business. Shortly after my report. And that was really my first role outside of the, audit department. I then started a division for the company that was called the Servicing Acquisition and Sales Division. At that time, in the mid-80s, Countrywide had recently gotten an investment grade credit rating. For its long-term debt by the rating agencies, allowing Countrywide to borrow on the public markets, and the business plan was to grow our servicing portfolio and finance it with public debt, and so I was charged with starting a division to do that, to acquire servicing rights in the market, and then also from time to time to sell servicing rights. That led me to start another division or a business unit for Countrywide, where having accumulated significant expertise in the acquisition and sale of servicing rights as a principal for Countrywide, and having been one of the largest participants in the market, I made a proposal to my superiors for them to approve the starting of a advisory and brokerage subsidiary specializing in the servicing rights markets, where we would assist other companies as either a broker or a advisor or to provide valuation services. And And that company, called Countrywide Servicing Exchange, in the ensuing years, grew to become the number one player in kind of that niche industry, the servicing rights market. My next assignment, while I retained oversight for both our servicing brokerage subsidiary and the division at Countrywide that bought and sold servicing for its own account, I was then given additional responsibility which was to oversee our correspondent lending operation. So the thinking was my customers in the servicing rights business were other financial institutions in the mortgage market, banks and more other mortgage companies, and savings and loans and the like, and these were also the customers of our correspondent division, which was a division that purchased loans from these same companies, that was my next role for a while, and we enjoyed some success. The correspondent division grew to become the number one correspondent lender in the country, is my recollection, while I oversaw that division. And then I also was asked to take over, while retaining oversight responsibility for the operations that I described that I then oversaw, I also was asked to take oversight responsibility for a securities company, an NASD registered broker dealer called Countrywide Securities Corporation, which is a very small company, only had a handful of employees, the thought was to seek to build that out to be a more material, full service sales, trading, and securities firm. The premise being, to essentially vertically diversify, and that Countrywide was at the time one of the largest, if not the largest, I can't recall, originator of mortgage assets and securitizer. That we had theretofore distributed, all of our securities and our assets to the street, who in turn sold them to directly to the institutional investor community. And the thought was, why not start and build out a business ourselves that could do that, such that we didn't need to sell everything to Wall Street and could sell directly and enjoy the margins, therefore, or the economics that were enjoyed by Wall Street, and that was the next area I took over, and that business also grew to be quite successful. Then in the year 2000, I was promoted again, this time to oversee all of our production operations. So we're before I only had oversight for kind of our institutional businesses, the correspondent operation, the servicing business, and the securities firm. I now had responsibility for the rest of Countrywide's production divisions, and I believe my title at that time I can't recall exactly, but it was something like Senior Managing Director of Loan Production and Capital Markets. And I was the chief production officer as well. Either concurrent with that promotion in 2000 or perhaps shortly thereafter, I also assumed oversight for the servicing side of Countrywide's business, so that I had production as well as servicing. And then I think the next promotion I received was in 2004, where I became executive managing director of mortgage banking and capital markets. And I don't recall whether there were any notable increases in responsibility or perhaps just a promotion. I think we created a layer of management, the company called executive managing director, and I was one of the EMDs. Then in early 06, in April 06, I received a promotion my title became Executive Managing Director of Business Segment Operations, where in addition to the responsibilities I had at that time, I also now assumed oversight responsibility for Countrywide Bank, as well as, you know, a variety of administrative areas in the company, such as marketing and technology and human resources. And I would say everything except for the risk management, the investment management, and the legal area of the company. And then in September of 2006, I was promoted to President and Chief Operating Officer of the parent company, succeeding the then COO of Stanford Kurland. So that's kind of the history.
Okay, and then moving ahead to 08, when Bank of America takes over Countrywide, acquires Countrywide, did you continue on with B of A?
You know, in substance, no. I think I stayed around for a month or so after the merger became effective by design, and then to help with some transition issues, and I left.
So do you recall when you left?
It was in August of 2008.
Okay. All right, and I think the acquisition closed in July of 08, if I'm not mistaken. So that
yes.
Makes sense. Okay, I'm going to want to focus on the time frame 2000 forward, I think. It sounds like during that entire time, you were pretty much in charge of the mortgage banking segment of the company, whether it was the production or the servicing divisions within that segment. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say early on, I was the chief production officer, mm-hmm. I think from 2000 to 2004. And then, you know, one thing that did occur in 2004 is we brought in another individual, his name was Andrew Gissinger, to become the chief production officer, and he oversaw the, you know, kind of what he had assumed my role, you know, up until that point, you know, overseeing the business day to day. The heads of our production divisions reported up to him, and he reported to me, so I still had oversight of our mortgage banking business, but he was the chief production officer from 04 forward.
Okay. And actually, I actually wanted to ask you a little bit, have you describe sort of who the people are, what the organizational structure is in that time frame generally? Can you give me who the main players are on the production and servicing side?
In 00 or in 04?
In 00 to 08 when you leave.
Yeah,
there's a lot of changes. We can try to shorten it up.
It didn't change that materially. Up until 04, we had four production divisions at Countrywide, our retail division, we call our consumer markets division. We had another consumer direct operation called Full Spectrum Lending. Those two together were our retail, we viewed as our retail businesses. Then we had a wholesale division, you know, referred to as WLD, the acronym for Wholesale Lending Division. We had a correspondent division, as I said, the company that I had oversaw before 2000, and those were the four divisions, two retail and then a correspondent and wholesale. The heads of those divisions, you know, reported directly to me through the, you know, as I said, through the, you know, through the time that Andrew Gissinger took over. Their names were Doug Jones oversaw the correspondent division, Todd Dal Porto oversaw the wholesale division. We had two individuals, you know, we had a change in leadership in the consumer markets division. At one point, it was a gentleman by the name of Joe Anderson, and then he was succeeded by a gentleman by the name of Brian Hale, who ran that division until the time of the merger. And then in our full spectrum lending division, the individual oversaw that. His name was Greg Lumsden. And so those, with the exception of the change in the consumer markets division, those were the heads of the four production divisions. And they reported up to me. And as I said, after 04, at some point, they reported to Drew Gissinger, who reported to me.
Okay. And what about the servicing side of the mortgage banking?
And so the at the time that I assumed responsibility for the servicing division, the person who ran that operation, his name was Richard DeLeo. He had retired at some point, I can't recall when, and he was succeeded by a gentleman by the name of Steve Bailey. Steve Bailey reported to me directly through some period of time. It was at, you know, 04, perhaps even later than 04. It might have even been 05 or even 06, I can't recall. But then I promoted an individual from our correspondent area by the name of Jack Shackett to become the chief operations officer of Countrywide Home Loans. And then Steve Bailey, as the head of servicing, reported to him. So production reported up to Drew Gissinger, and servicing reported up to Jack Shackett.
Okay. And then I know another, just to close out the loop, the other segment that you said that you were in charge of was actually Countrywide Bank, right? And I know Mr. Garcia was the CEO of that bank, but just explain to me the reporting relationships there, please.
I really had very little to do with Countrywide Bank up until April of 2006. So the bank was started through the acquisition of a charter in 2001, a very small charter, and then, you know, and then it grew. Mm-hmm. Carlos Garcia was the head. I think his title might have been chairman and at one point and CEO at another point. But he was the, you know, the head of that business, and it really ran, you know, it was a sister company to Countrywide Home Loans, which I oversaw. And, you know, another of my titles was president of Countrywide Home Loans, you know, at the subsidiary level. And earlier I gave you my titles at the corporate level. And so he was a peer of mine, overseeing the bank. I oversaw the mortgage company. You know, I was certainly, you know, peripherally, you know, aware of the strategy applicable to Countrywide Bank, but I was not an officer of the bank. I was not a member of the board of the bank. I wasn't really very involved in the, you know, any of the nuts and bolts or decisions, you know, that the bank was making relative to, you know, its business plan and its investment strategy and so forth until I took over in the second quarter of 2006. At which point Carlos Garcia reported to me for the first time.
Okay. And then I've at least seen in the company's quarterly earnings releases and SEC filings there was a capital markets segment and an insurance segment. Were you involved in either of those segments?
Yes. As I said, you know, the capital – well, I didn't clarify the – the securities company that I took over before 2000 ultimately was rolled into a newly created holding company that we called Countrywide Capital Markets, and it had Countrywide Capital Markets had a number of subsidiaries, one of which was the NASD broker-dealer securities company, another of which was the servicing rights company that I kind of, you know, started in the, you know, the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And then we started some other businesses. We had an asset management firm, and all of those operations underneath the holding entity called Countrywide Capital Markets were also lumped together as our capital markets segment for external kind of reporting and descriptive purposes. And I had I had oversight over that business from the point that I took over the securities firm.
Okay.
With respect to insurance, at some point I took over, and I can't recall if it was in April of 06 when I was promoted to head of business segment operations or earlier, but I believe it was in April of 06. It might have been earlier. I also assumed oversight for Countrywide's insurance businesses.
Okay. And then on the other side of it, throughout the 2000 to 2008 time frame, who are you reporting to? It sounds like for some of the time to Kurland and then to Mr. Mazzillo, but tell me if I'm mistaken.
Yeah, so as it happens, you know, from my being hired at Countrywide in 1985, through the time I became president of the company, I reported the whole time to Mr. Kurland. And then when he left and I succeeded him, I reported directly to Angelo Mazzillo in September of 06.
Okay, and just, I think you already said this, but it was September of 06 when you succeeded Mr. Kurland, is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. So I want to, let's get to the substance now of the questions. And I want to ask you generally about how, in terms of the loan origination function, how either underwriting standards changed or products that were being offered changed over time. And let me tell you a few things that we've seen in terms of the financial results, public results, and some of the things we've seen in the documents and interviews that we've had so far that I don't think will be very surprising. You know, one, we see Countrywide becomes the number one loan originator, I think, in the 04, 05, 06, 07 time frame. And it's got high teens, I think, is its market share percentage. We see an increase in the amount of originations of the non-traditional mortgage product, whether it's the option payment arm, whether it's subprime, whether it's Alt-A, et cetera. And we see the growth over time and through 2006, you know, positive earnings, growth in the servicing portfolio, growth in the bank, growth in gain on sale, et cetera. And then, of course, we get in towards the end of 06, and primarily from the conference call, earnings calls that I'm sure you have memories of, things start to turn a little. Home price appreciation, the rate of growth slows, and then it goes negative. The metrics in terms of delinquency start to go up, the provisions start to go up, the impairment costs go up on the retained portfolio. And then you get into August of 07, and you've got, I think, a ballpark $12 billion pipeline that you can't sell. The repo lenders won't roll. The commercial paper lenders won't roll. You have to draw the backup lines, and then you continue to report losses in 07, 08, and the Bank of America deal gets done. With that, at least my quick and dirty summary of what I've at least seen in terms of the financial results, and particularly since, you know, we see a lot of the impairment charges and the loan loss provisions on the non-traditional mortgage product, give me your general understanding or belief or opinions on what happened over that time at Countrywide and how product underwriting changed and what you believe got the company into trouble.
And let me just caution you. Mr. Seifer has taken some incredibly complex periods of time and collapsed them into about 30 seconds. So answer the question in your own words as you see fit.
Yeah. Well, I think what happened at Countrywide mirrored what happened in the overall U.S. mortgage market during this period. You know, Countrywide, as you probably know, was primarily a mortgage banker, and its business model was an originate-to-distribute business model. For its decades of existence before this 2000 time period when underwriting guidelines got expanded and, you know, there was a growth in non-conforming or non-traditional product lending. And so the difference between what, you know, the loans that Countrywide made, say, you know, before this period and after this period was that the loans that were being securitized and sold in the secondary market, you know, at some point were really for the most part just, you know, agency conforming loans and the conventional loans saleable to Fannie Freddie, FHA and VA loans securitizable into Ginnie Mae securities and saleable as Ginnie Mae securities and to a much lesser extent you know, jumbo loans that had similar guidelines to conventional Fannie Freddie loans, but, you know, but were of larger loan balances. And really that represented, you know, the U.S. mortgage market. And so we were, in many ways, you know, at before guideline expansion, a mirror of the U.S. mortgage market, and, you know, and our share of the different product types is probably consistent with the overall market share. Beginning in, I would say, 2003, for you know, many reasons, the guidelines were expanded in the U.S. mortgage market. The share, you know, if the market during that period was $3 trillion or thereabouts, $2.5 to $3.5 trillion of originations, the share of that total pie represented by agency conforming loans, you know, dropped significantly from the mid-60s to, you know, the 30s or, you know, 40% neighborhood, and non-conforming loans, non-traditional loans, their share of the market increased dramatically, and they increased because there was investor demand for these products, explained by, you know, again, a variety of in my opinion, of underlying reasons, and countrywide, as the market, as guidelines expanded, as these other loans were being offered in the marketplace and then being sold, securitized and sold into the secondary markets, consistent with Countrywide's long-standing business model of originating that which was saleable into the secondary market and being essentially a supermarket, a model, you know, that is very common to other mortgage bankers. You know, we ourselves began originating, you know, these loans more as, I would say, a follower than a leader, and that's what happened during this period.
Okay, let me ask you some follow-up questions. So you mentioned beginning in 2003 that the guidelines expanded. Prior to that time, in your 85 to 2003 stint at Countrywide, was Countrywide making, you know, non-traditional mortgage loans at that time, loans that were not saleable to Fannie and Freddie and Ginnie?
Yes, you know, and I would say, and it wasn't necessarily 2003. I think it just the pace, perhaps, mm-hmm. increased. You know, the market share of non-traditional loans or non-conforming loans, you know, increased after 2003, and you know, in the 2004 to 2006 time period. But it probably started before 2003, perhaps even, you know, around 2000. But the answer is yes. Countrywide's, you know, business model, as I said, was to originate all loans that were otherwise being originated in the marketplace, which were saleable into the secondary market. And so, to the extent that there was a market for non Fannie Freddie conforming loans, non-agency loans, we were originating those loans as well. Most of that we called, you know, jumbo loans, but you know, as a category, you know, I would have viewed those as our non-agency conforming business, and it was, you know, a much smaller percentage of our business before 2003, as it was a much smaller percentage of the overall market before 2003.
So who were those loans being who were the non-agency loans being sold to in the 90s?
Institutional investors. The buyers for non-agency loans were, you know, the gamut of financial institutions that invested in either mortgage assets or mortgage securities. And so it might have either been depository institutions like banks and savings and loans who desired to own loans, you know, as outright whole loans in their portfolio, and we would sell some of our production of those loans to them. And then to the extent that we securitized these loans into non-agency mortgage-backed securities, you know, there are a variety of profiles of institutional investors that invested in mortgage securities, you know, again, ranging from banks to insurance companies to mutual funds to asset managers to, you know, municipalities, foreign governments, and the like.
Mm-hmm. In the 90s, I know when you get into the 2000s, a lot of the product is being sold to the street for securitizations. Was there much of that in the 90s?
Well, it all got sold through the street. So the street acted as the, you know, financial intermediary between originators like Countrywide and the investors who ultimately bought the mortgage assets, either in securitized form or whole loan form.
Mm-hmm.
So and that would have been the case, you know, before and after.
Okay. Was there any? All I'm trying to understand in terms of timing is whether things changed, and if so, when, and in particular, whether there came a time where more loans were being sold to the street for securitizations as opposed to loans being the street facilitating sales of loans to institutional investors in loan form or even in securities form, if there was an increase in the growth in that at some point.
I'm sorry, is your question whether the street, whether there's a transition where the street was simply underwriting securities for issuers and selling securities as opposed to buying the loans?
Let me try again. My question is, and I'm sorry for butchering it, did there come a time where Countrywide was selling more loans to Wall Street that Wall Street was simply securitizing and into either mortgage-backed securities or structured securities? Did that dynamic change at all over time?
Well, Countrywide was selling virtually all of its production to Wall Street, either in the form of mortgage-backed securities or in the form of mortgage whole loans. And so even with respect to our agency production, you know, we would create a mortgage-backed security guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie, and we would sell it to Wall Street. If it was a non-agency conforming loan or non-agency conforming productions, by virtue of Countrywide size, we, you know, were an issuer of securities, so we were able to create a security, you know, as the issuer or sponsor, and then we would sell the security or resulting securities. You know, tend to be, as I'm sure you're aware, tranches, you know, of securities. We would sell all those to Wall Street. And then from time to time, we would sell Wall Street raw whole loans, and they would, you know, pool those with other whole loans they might be buying from other originators and themselves create a security as the sponsor or issuer, like we did in those cases where we created the security. I would say for the most part, we were a seller of securities to Wall Street. I would say the majority of our non-agency business was sold to Wall Street in securitized form. And a minority was sold in raw whole loan form, and you know the mix I'm not really, you know, familiar with.
Okay.
And the balance you kept at the bank, because there was a significant balance that was kept at the bank as a growing business.
Well, yes, I would say that the way, you know, stepping back, the way that it worked with respect to, you know, this originate to distribute model that was at the core of our business model, and then the loans that we kept for the bank is that, you know, Countrywide, its business strategy was to originate through our mortgage business those loans which were saleable into the market without regard to whether or not the bank had a desire to keep them or which loans they had a desire to keep. It was really, you know, our product offerings were based on that which was saleable into the market. In fact, we had a product strategy and philosophy that you know, that we framed as you know, we'll originate those loans that, you know, number one, are otherwise broadly offered in the marketplace. We didn't feel that we needed to be a leader and an innovator in new types of loans because, our strength was elsewhere. But so we would originate those loans that were otherwise, broadly offered in the marketplace, provided that there were, and then we had certain filters. The first filter is provided that we could sell those loans into the secondary marketplace. Originating them would not have we would not have been required to keep them. So that there was a secondary market and demand for those products was the first filter. The second filter was that we wanted to make sure we would only originate loans that were appropriate for consumers that we felt the consumers would pay back. And one of the ways that manifested itself was that we had a criteria that we would not originate any loans, the interest rate and points of which, would exceed some threshold that, was a, we refer to as the HOPA, high cost limit. You might be familiar with that term. And so there's an act, the Home Ownership Protection Act, that establishes that any loans, the APR of which, whether it's the points or the interest rate, exceeds a certain level, those loans are deemed high cost loans under this statute, this HOPA statute, and then those loans, may be originated, but there's additional disclosures and risks associated with such lending. We established that we would not originate any loans that needed to be priced to a level that would exceed that. So again, our view was, loans that would have an expected default rate, that would be above a level that would, that would put them into a HOPA threshold. So that was the second filter. And then we also had a catch-all filter that we, only sought to make loans, that we felt would not adversely impact, Countrywide's reputation. So that was kind of the general philosophy behind Countrywide's the products that it offered, right behind the loans which it originated, loans that were already being originated in the market, loans for which there was investor appetite that were saleable in the market, that such where the risk of those loans could be priced, and loans where we felt would not impact our reputation or would not, be high-cost loans.
And I just want to jump in for a second.
Sure.
I think before Al had asked his question, the discussion had been on comparing the 90s to the period of time later and the extent to which the company was selling whole loans or securities to Wall Street. And I think you injected the bank into this, which I think was a different variable that, first of all, didn't exist in the 90s. So I think we need to be clear about what time periods we're talking about.
So then getting to your question, that represented the aggregate originations of Countrywide. And then when we started the bank, the plan was to grow the bank. And to grow its balance sheet, to make it a sizable bank, more of like a thrift-like institution in that it would invest primarily in residential mortgage loans like other savings and loans, the hope being that ultimately we could fold the entire business under the bank. And so the need was to grow the bank, in part for that reason, in part, we felt that there are other strategic reasons I could get into. And with respect to the assets that the bank would invest in, it wasn't that we would add products to our menu that were kind of the bank was a sponsor for that weren't otherwise saleable. The bank was allowed to take those loans that we were originating at the mortgage company and keep those loans that it desired to invest in. And so they had investment criteria. They had a credit risk profile that was a lot more conservative than the overall profile of loans that we were originating for which there was investor demand. They didn't, for example, invest in subprime loans and so forth. And so the bank kind of culled from the much broader, much bigger origination volume that we had at Countrywide a small portion of our production, and I believe that it was something less than 10% of 5 to 10%, maybe below 5% in some years of Countrywide's overall production. And so really, the way it would work is Countrywide would originate say $400 to $500 billion a year of origination volume through its different channels. The bank would, you know, would take, you know, 20 to 40 billion a year of that, and then the rest we would sell in the market. And had it not been for the bank, you know, we could have sold all of the loans that the bank kept also in the market. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know from at least looking at 06 and 07, your earnings releases, that you would disclose your loan production as prime, non-prime, and HELOC. Would the bank buy any of the non-prime or HELOC?
You know, I think the technical term was originate, because, you know, even though the operations of Countrywide Home Loans would source the loans, would process and fulfill the loans, the bank, quote unquote, right, would originate
so
those loans.
Right. So would it originate and hold any subprime and any?
It would not. Well, it would not hold in its investment portfolio any subprime. At some later point, when everything was originated under the bank became, you know, a mortgage banker itself. Mm-hmm. And so we would originate through the bank for the purpose of selling into the secondary market. And so it might have, at some later point, originated subprime loans, mm-hmm, for the purpose of selling those. But right, in terms of that which the bank sought to originate for investment in its investment portfolio, it did not invest in any subprime. It did invest in home equity loans.
Okay.
And this is, I think you've heard from others that this was largely a function of what the regulators,
right,
would permit.
Right. Right.
Is that consistent with your knowledge?
Yes, that's right. It's in the early years of the bank, I think in the first 3 years, that which the bank could do, it was in a period that the regulators referred to as the de novo period.
Right.
You know, it was very restrictive relative to what, you know, banks that were not in a de novo period were allowed to do, and so that did very much impact what the bank invested in. But even thereafter, you know, bank could only invest in that which, you know, the regulators feel comfortable that the bank is investing in.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in I think you said beginning in 2003 that the guidelines started to expand. Two questions: how did the guidelines expand, and why did they expand?
Well, I'll comment on kind of the macroeconomic factors as I saw them. You know, that converge to explain why guidelines expanded, and very fundamentally, it was, you know, supply and demand factors, and starting with demand. You know, at you know, for the period, you know, before 2003, 2004, you know, we were in a very accommodative, you know, interest rate environment. Interest rates are very low. Yields to investors, fixed income investors, were very low, and there was an increasing appetite amongst institutional and sophisticated investors to invest in assets that had higher, more risk, and by extension, you know, higher yields, higher compensation in return for the additional risk. And so the secondary mortgage markets, you know, in the U.S. and really globally, increased in sophistication, securitization, you know, competencies, you know, evolved. And so I would say that the secondary market you know, evolved and expanded, and, you know, in participation and sophistication, allowing, you know, investors to price and assets with more risk, both in the residential mortgage area, and you know, this is commonplace in other asset sectors, you know, corporate debt markets, leverage loans, and the like, and so that happened. Demand increased. Fueled, as I said, by you know, desire for additional, you know, returns, higher returns, and, you know, and associated higher levels of risk. And then there was also a supply. You know, there was a demand on the consumer side. What we had was we went through a period of great housing appreciation. There was affordability issues as a result, you know, particularly on the coasts, where consumers were looking for products that would you know, enable them to, you know, to buy homes still and have mortgage products that fell into the category of being, you know, affordability products, and so there was demand for, you know, amongst consumers or for those loans. Government policy was such, you know, that it promoted the origination of some of these non-traditional loans. We had an environment where there was a significant gap in the home ownership rate between white Americans and minorities, African Americans and Hispanics, a significant gap, and there was a frequently stated desire, you know, in Congress, you know, that gap needed to be narrowed, and the solution, you know, to that was, in part, you know, offering products that enabled, you know, more people to qualify, you know, products that required lesser down payments, products that required, that allowed for slightly higher debt ratios, things like that. And so that was another, you know, factor, you know, contributing to this dynamic of growth in a non you know, traditional or non-conforming products. There was demand on the part of investors, and there was supply and demand on the part of consumers for the product. And in Countrywide's case, you know, Countrywide was an intermediary. Countrywide, the way we looked at ourselves as a mortgage banker, was essentially a conduit, you know, offering products into the primary market, meaning to consumers, that which was essentially offered, or, you know, for which there was demand by the secondary market from investors.
And when you say that Countrywide is underwriting its loans based on what can be sold to the secondary market, you know, is the street providing rate sheets? I mean, what kind of information are you guys working off of to know what can be sold into the secondary market?
Well, as I said, you know, certainly the case that we had a division within Countrywide, we called it our secondary market department. And their job was to talk to the street or talk to investors and talk to the rating agencies to understand that which they would buy, that which they would securitize, or that we could securitize, that which the rating agencies would rate, and that for which there was demand. And that was kind of their job, to be intimate and understand as to what was securitizable and saleable into the secondary market. As a practical matter, as I said, almost all of the, you know, the non-traditional, non-conforming guidelines that are in loan programs that we added to our menu, if you will, or that we originated, were, before we started originating them, they were already being originated and sold into the secondary market before we started. You know, as I said, we tended to be almost exclusively a follower. And so it was really a matter of, you know, of adopting that which, you know, was already done before us, before we came in. And the way
can
in which
I stop you for one second? So when you said they, as a practical matter, all these products that were added to your menu were already available before, but I take it before they weren't sellable to the secondary market?
No, they were. You know, what was happening during this period, as I said, was those that were product leaders. Those were the first to market, you know, with respect to some of these products. And I think there were in some cases, there were specialty finance companies, like subprime companies surfaced during this time period, or companies engaged in primarily the Alt-A market surfaced in this period. And I would say they primarily maybe were the innovators. And then there were some other, you know, more traditional companies perhaps that might have innovated as well and worked with the street on creating a product that, you know, that this, the, with the street, it was determined that it could be sold.
Mm-hmm.
And so Countrywide being a follower, we tended to lag. In terms of when we would, if and when we would offer these products after they were already being originated. So it's not the case that at any point in time, you know, if we weren't originating it, it wasn't saleable, because it probably was saleable. But during the period of 04 to 06, what was happening, the pace of expansion in guidelines in the mortgage market was fairly fast. And you know, during this period, it seemed as if every quarter there was, you know, lenders were expanding the guidelines, investors, you know, loans with expanded underwriting guidelines or attributes, you know, were being originated and being priced. And so in every case, you know, the secondary market, the way it worked, would demand a higher yield. You know, there would be that would translate into, you know, higher pricing or higher interest rates to the consumer, and this was happening at a pace where if you were to plot, you know, it on a curve, you know, expansion and guidelines, while it probably was occurring slowly from the 90s to 2003, you know, the curve was somewhat flat. But you know, starting in this period of 04 to 06, it became very steep. And so Countrywide, being, you know, is one of the top mortgage lenders, if not the top mortgage lender, when this was happening, and it was a supermarket, and it was incumbent on us, you know, in order to, you know, remain viable as a monoline mortgage company, to offer that which was otherwise being offered in the market, you know, as I said, subject to the filters that I described.
Okay. So this secondary market division that was talking to the street and the rating agencies, what division was that within Countrywide?
It's called the secondary market division.
That makes sense. And who headed up that division?
It was headed up, it fell ultimately under the chief investment officer. The chief investment officer of the company had the secondary marketing department. It also had the, you know, credit risk management department, and there were other, you know, units underneath them. The person who headed that was for a long time. It was a gentleman by the name of Kevin Bartlett, and then he left the company, and he was succeeded by a guy by the name of Nick Kresnick. And then Nick Kresnick left the company in 2006, and we brought Kevin Bartlett back in to become the chief investment officer. At different points in time, under Kevin and Nick, who oversaw that secondary marketing department, they had another lieutenant, if you will, that, you know, kind of day-to-day ran secondary marketing. At one point, it was Kevin Bartlett himself before the role of chief investment officer got created. But then there was a guy by the name of David Spector, who ran secondary marketing at one point, and he was succeeded by a guy named Josh Adler, who
you've already talked to.
Okay.
Just wanted you to remember that.
So were you finished before Reg so rudely interrupted?
Yeah, I think I was finished.
Okay. Is it accurate then to say that from this division, would this division essentially spit out the rate sheets about what kind of product Countrywide could originate? We have seen, for example, loan program guides from Countrywide, and we see the guidelines getting changed and loosened. You know, for example, like on, I think we were looking at the payment option arm book the other day, and the cumulative LTV was going up, and the FICO score could go down, et cetera. It just explained to me how it worked. I mean, if I'm accurately describing this, tell me, and if I'm not, tell me how I'm not.
Well, yeah. So for instance, spit out, I'm sure is a phrase you're not going to use, but go ahead and answer the question.
So mechanically, so we had this this business model, this mortgage banking business model, you know, defined as I, you know, described as I described it, originate that which is being originated, and which could be sold, and provided that it met these other filters, and we, you know, we attempted to kind of be there, you know, at any point in time, and as the market was moving quickly, we had a unit within Countrywide Home Loans, you know, a unit that reported up to the chief production officer. It subsequently, was named product leadership. It might have had another name at some earlier point, but the job of, you know, the function of this little division was to receive input from all sources on products that were being originated in the marketplace by our competitors, so that we could determine if they, you know, our own product menu and our own guidelines should be changed consistent with the strategy and the philosophy and what was being originated in the market. So they would receive input from our production divisions, you know, who usually, you know, became aware first, you know, when, you know, our business partners, our realtors and our builders and our brokers or our loan officers were telling us, look, these guys are originating this loan with this LTV. And then they were kind of like the conduit, or if you will, the quarterback in receiving requests, and then they would work with the other areas of the company, you know, first they would, you know, make a determination as to whether or not this was a product that we should in fact add to the menu, and the criteria that they would use is, you know, some of the criteria we gave them. Is it a high cost product, which would preclude it? Is it a product that, you know, that there's really, you know, the volume is notable, or is it, you know, completely immaterial and shouldn't, you know, really even, you know, be added to the list? And so they would, to the extent that there was a sponsor for the product, the production division's desire to have a product, or sometimes it's the bank, you know, saw something that they saw being originated in the market, they might be a sponsor. And sometimes it was even our secondary market department that became aware that something was happening, and they, you know, were the sponsor of a new product or guideline changes, and then that would start the process, and the product leadership division would prioritize which products or which guideline changes, you know, should be handled first, and then there would be a process with which that product would be reviewed by different areas, and different areas would need to sign off, and if all the sign offs were obtained, then the product would be rolled out, and the guidelines officially expanded, and the technology that we had to process loans, you know, would have to be modified, you know, as well, and that was kind of the process, and the approvals and the sign-offs needed to come from, you know, a variety of departments. The credit department was one. The secondary market department, you know, was another, having to determine, is this product really saleable? Because they're the ones that would price the product based on what they could sell the product for. The legal department, the servicing department, the, you know, technology development department. Can we modify the technology? And so there were a variety of areas in the company that would have to sign off. There was a very, you know, comprehensive, you know, an elaborate process to, you know, to change our product manual or guidelines, and that's kind of the way it happened, you know, not, you know, operationally.
Mm-hmm. Chris, we've been at an hour. Is this a decent place?
Yeah, let me ask one question, and then we'll take a break, since it's just on this topic, and it's on the issue of reports. We've seen loan program guides and see how they have changed over time, but is there documentation out there that, you know, if I wanted to get a better idea of how the menu changed and expanded during the decade of the 2000s at Countrywide, what would you look at? And hopefully what would you look at that wouldn't be a huge volume of documents?
Well, you know, I'm sure there are, it depends on what I was looking for. I think that to the extent that I was interested in seeing the, you know, as you suggested, the, you know, the trends and loan to value ratios, the trends in FICOs, the trends, you know, and, you know, with respect to the, you know, the mix of loans and the characteristics. There would be lots of reports, you know, that were produced by our, you know, credit risk management department, or under the chief investment officer, that showed, you know, the composition of our production and our originations.
And let me just follow up.
Specific report you've got in mind, because I'm sure I'm going to get
it. Right, and I'm trying to actually help Rich here, so that I don't have to ask him for a bunch more stuff. We have seen, for example, and have information on the composition of originations by loan type. I can see how many loans countrywide originated by quarter, for example, that were payment option arm, that were interest only, that were FICO,
and that were 620,
and that were Alt A. But what I don't see, at least I don't think what I've seen, is within those loan product groups, how the guidelines would have changed. You know, when could the, with a couple of exceptions, like on payment option arm, we have seen loan program guides where for the payment option arm, the CLTV can be higher now, the FICO score can be lower now. And all I'm trying to get, my goal is to try to get a better understanding of how the composition of originations by risk layer, not just within loan product group, changed over time. And I'm wondering if there's one or two places I can ask Reg to go to get me that information, and not a whole bunch of places to have to go.
But there's not.
Yeah, I think there was a, you know, it's fairly thick, but I think there were these books produced monthly called product books or something like that, and so they would, within these subcategories, show the composition of loans originated, you know, in terms of those characteristics, FICOs and LTVs, and the trends. If you wanted to see the result of the guideline changes, what was being originated. If you wanted to see a summary of what guideline changes were, I don't know what reports. I wouldn't have been a reader of those reports, but I knew that there were things kept in the product leadership area that showed all the, you know, there were many, many changes every month during this period to keep up with what was going on in the market. And so that they would have, you know, they would have had some reports there that showed what guideline changes they approved.
And I'm sorry, Reg, we'll get there when we just close the line on reports. How granular would the information be that went to the board? What kind of information would they get on the composition of originations or the retained portfolio?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Want to take a break?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
We're trying to get the air working.
It was warmer upstairs.
Mm-hmm.